Is number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, and one of the great concerns of this great nation, and it is intensifying because of recent events, is nuclear war. And I know that many Americans for many, many years have preferred to think if it was simply unthinkable. But thinking about the unthinkable is one of those things that leaders need to do. One of those leaders is Elliot Ackerman. He is the best-selling author of novels. His books have been nominated for both the National Book Award and the Andrew Carnegie Medal in both fiction and nonfiction. His novel that we're going to be talking about is 2034, which envisions a nuclear war, actually several scenarios for nuclear war. And he co-wrote it with Admiral James Stavridis. Mr. Ackerman is a Marine who served five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, and a Purple Heart. Mr. Ackerman, great to have you on the show. And after the recent missile that fell, no one knows exactly where it was from, but it fell in Poland. There was great concern about NATO becoming involved in a nuclear exchange. Your novel is entitled 2034 because it begins on March 12th, 2034. Do you really think we have that much time?
Well, I don't know necessarily that we do. First of all, thanks so much for having me on. But I think if there's one thing recent events have shown, it's how quickly events can escalate, and a small exchange of hostilities can quickly lead to a much larger exchange. What we do in the book 2034 is we imagine out that ladder of escalation in the aforementioned year, and in this case, it's a war that begins at sea that starts with a single incident between the Chinese and American navies.
Right, and and again, there are alternative scenarios that could lead to nuclear war involving Russia, North Korea, even Iran. What is the most immediate danger if you were to focus on one source that America should be prepared to confront?
Well, obviously, you know, we're all paying a lot of attention to what's going on in Ukraine right now. And, you know, the Russian invasion did not go according to Vladimir Putin's plans. It's been much more difficult than he thought it would be. And he has painted himself into a bit of a corner, as already the Russian military has lost much of the ground it ceded. And as I said, it's ceded to the Ukraine's due to its underperformance. So a cornered animal is always the most dangerous one. And the Russians long have a doctrine on the books, which they call escalate to de-escalate, which is the use of a low-grade tactical nuclear weapon or dirty weapon, which is a non-nuclear weapon that scatters radioactive dust. But to use one of those weapons in order to escalate a conflict in order to then subsequently de-escalate it by sort of turning the tables, as it were. So I think we need to be very cautious when watching Ukraine to make sure that the Russians don't engage in those types of behaviors.
What is the most dramatic action, the most immediate action that the president, this president or the next president, this Congress or the next Congress should take to avert the dangers that you place in the future in the book 2034?
Well, you know, Ukraine and Taiwan and, you know, Iran and all of these international scenarios aside, you know, I would put to you that actually the single greatest danger that faces our nation, our sort of single great point of weakness, is in fact our own internal dysfunction. So I would hope our next president, whoever he or she might be, will address the divisiveness and the vitriol of politics that exist here at home. Because if when our adversaries see us, they see a nation that is incapable of unifying when attacked, it makes it more likely that they attack. So, you know, it doesn't mean we have to agree on everything in the United States, but, you know, but if we are seen as cohesive, that in and of itself is a real deterrent to our adversaries. You know, outside of that, once we get beyond our shores, that deterrent comes in the means that it's always come, which is not only through strong diplomacy, but also having a, you know, a strong and ready military and maintaining our presence around the globe where we've long been, everywhere from South Pacific to Eastern Europe.
You served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think everyone remembers those days after September 11th, 2001. We did not appear to have the same kind of difficulty in unifying and coming together as a nation. I remember that members of Congress of both parties came on the Capitol steps mm-hmm. and sang God Bless America. And for a few months, at least, there seemed to be tremendous rallying of the country. That's harder to imagine today. Why do you think it is?
Oh, I agree with you. It is hard to imagine. And, you know, for many years, maybe you had similar versions of this conversation. I would speak with friends and I would sort of wonder, you know, what is it going to take for us as a country to come together again? You know, maybe it'll be a real cataclysmic event. And then the pandemic arrived, and as opposed to uniting Americans, it actually, I think, led to a couple of the most divisive years in our history. Strangely enough, the closest that I came to feeling the type of unity that you mentioned after, for instance, the September 11th attacks was in the days and weeks after the Russian invasion in Ukraine. We saw very, very strong bipartisan condemnation of Russia's actions in the Congress. And it seemed as though we had kind of harnessed a little bit of that unity again. So, again, I'm not, you know, I don't think this is something that is no longer within our grasp as a nation, but I think it's important, and it's also incumbent on our leaders to figure out the things that we can all still rally around, even if there are other things that we, you know, cannot and maybe never will totally agree upon. So when we talk about national security threats, yes, it's important to sort of, you know, tour the globe and talk about these hotspots, but it's also important to never lose sight of the fact that our national security starts at home.
That is such a profound word, and I hope that everybody takes it with you to Thanksgiving celebrations coming up and after this segment is over. I hope you will join us again for a more extended conversation, Mr. Ackerman, because what you had to say is deeply profound. The book 2034 is posted on our website, and it begins quietly with a U.S. Commodore whose name is Sarah Hunt in the novel. She's on the bridge of her flagship and in the South China Sea. And there is a coordinated attack, as I understand it, involving Iran and China, which actually is, talk about keeping up to date with current events and with the intercontinental ballistic missile that Kim Jong-un in Korea is playing with. We live in very frightening times. But they become less frightening if you can rely on your neighbor and your fellow countrymen and our great military. Elliot Ackerman, have a wonderful weekend. We have a wonderful movie coming up that actually could do something to unite Americans. We'll
Sign up today for the free MedVid newsletter with new columns, commentaries, and movie reviews. Go to michaelmedved.com.
And it comes out every week, comes out Friday, and it's one of those things that is absolutely free, no cost to you at all. There is one item that we were talking about earlier when we were talking about the idea of the destruction in Ukraine and comparing it to some of the state of American cities. It's not fair because obviously the levels of suffering by innocent civilians again, military, you expect to suffer, but the cruelty and the crime against civilians by the Russian invasion is appalling and bestial. But there is been a development in Seattle and frankly across the country that makes people feel that they are going through their own pattern of unnecessary destruction. It has to do with the trashing of our cities and our places of business and living spaces, neighborhoods, all of it, by this explosion in graffiti, which is very prominent in Seattle, but it's not only Seattle. This is a report from Como News.
Graffiti covers our stop signs, parking signs, speed limit, and directional signs. To put it plainly, drivers are over it.
A lot of times signs will be, things will be whited out, or sometimes they'll change the lettering or change the arrow. I've seen signs just ripped apart.
Unfortunately, accidents do happen because of the vandalism on the signs, and it's just very unfortunate.
This person on Twitter writing to WashDOT, can your team look at exit signs on I-5 around downtown? Many are covered in graffiti and hard to read as a result. There seems to be no inspection.
We understand the frustration. We're out here painting throughout most of the day and visiting some of the same spots that have been painted over before.
We followed WashDOT crews to one of their scheduled cleanups. It's a meticulous process. The men are hand painting over graffiti covering the side of I-5.
Again, it's painting on the signs. Is it impossible to get this situation under control? Here's more from Como News.
WashDOT says between 2019 and 2021, $1.4 million was spent cleaning up graffiti along roads, bridges, and freeways in the greater Seattle area. SDOT says they spend over $1.4 million a year cleaning up graffiti.
It's very frustrating because the traveling public depends on those traffic signs for safety, for directions, for efficiency in travel.
For SDOT crews, the challenge is similar. They say there are more than 200,000 signs around Seattle, and it's impossible to know the condition of all of them.
I always would encourage people to, you know, be patient with us and know that we're out there working on this and trying our best to provide the best service we possibly can.
WashDOT cameras often catch the vandals live and in action. This group is seen here tagging, almost getting hit by oncoming traffic. While there's no specific penalty relating to traffic sign graffiti, the Seattle City Attorney's Office says this type of crime is classified as property destruction, subject to up to 364 days in jail and a $5,000 fine. Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell released his proposal in October to expand the city's ongoing effort to deal with graffiti. Collaboration with WashDOT and SDOT is a part of that. Tyra Major.
This is one of those things where it just seems the good guys who are trying to do their job are badly outnumbered. And if you have video cameras that are catching the vandals in action and they come close to being hit several times, imagine you're in one of those cars that runs into somebody in a situation like that. I mean, and if you're traveling at 60 miles an hour or 70, that could be an extraordinarily unpleasant moment. But this is an appalling factor in urban life. I think it makes many people. I'll talk about me people. Just reluctant to go downtown. And I do all the time, but this idea that we're helpless in the face of that, at least Mayor Harrell speaks against it and speaks against that idea of helplessness in the front of in the face of the graffiti assaults. This is Mayor Harrell talking about his new One Seattle Graffiti plan, which is intended to help increase enforcement and to help beautify the city. Mayor Harrell
is calling it the One Seattle Graffiti Plan, and it would rely on more than $940,000 of the mayor's proposed budget. Now, Mayor Bruce Harrell says he wants to make that investment because since 2019, incidents of graffiti reported by the public have grown 50%. The city says there were nearly 20,000 reports of graffiti and tagging last year alone. The mayor's plan includes increasing the number of city staff that respond to graffiti, offering abatement services at low or no cost to property owners, providing 1,000 abatement kits and training to businesses, also implementing larger penalties for the most prolific taggers, and engaging with artists, businesses, and volunteers to find more spaces for public art.
Perhaps there's some cultural art in certain areas where they're trying to keep their culture and preserve it, and we could beautify that area. That's the work we're going to do in addition to abatement and enforcement. So we have a great opportunity here in this approach. It's a One Seattle approach, and we'll get to know the graffiti community probably unlike any other administrations have known them before.
Enforcement and toughening penalties, and it is not simply a Seattle problem anymore. It's worse in Seattle than and again, this city was so striking for its superiority to California cities when we first arrived here. And today it's changed. The Wall Street Journal has a piece today by two veteran Democrats. And the headline is Trump or Biden, how about neither? Joe Biden and Donald Trump, please do the country a service and don't run for president in 2024. Is it too late to get President Trump to withdraw? I think it's possible at some point in the campaign he might, but depends on how it's going for him. America's in gridlock over the both of you, and it's time to let the country progress and find a unifying force that can lead it into the next decade. According to a November 1014 Morning Consult poll, 65% of Americans don't want Biden to run again, and 65% say the same about Donald Trump. Both of you have served this country, yet both of you have flaws and problems that stand in the way of a successful second term or a successful presidential race. We will get right back to it coming up on The MedVet Show.
Makes no sense.
The Michael MedVet Show.
And on the Michael Medved show, last night, Lauren Boebert, the embattled Congress lady from Western Colorado, declared victory in her reelection bid. That's one of the six unsettled House races. But the race has not been fully called because they may be going to a legally required recount because it is so close. But this is the way Congresswoman Boebert sounded in claiming her win. Listen.
Great news tonight, as almost all the votes have finally been tallied. I'm told that there are less than 200 votes outstanding, which makes me so happy to announce we have won this race. With this victory and with Republicans in control of the House of Representatives, we can focus on the issues that actually matter most, including getting inflation under control, increasing our domestic energy supply, securing the southern border, and being a strong check on the White House. Now, over the next couple of weeks, this race will have an automatic recount, which will be completed in early December. My campaign team and our lawyers will definitely make sure everything is conducted properly. Past recounts in Colorado have resulted in far fewer votes being adjusted than anything that could affect the current outcome we're seeing tonight in this race. So come January, you can be certain of two things. I will be sworn in for my second term as your congresswoman, and Republicans can finally turn Pelosi's house back into the people's house.
Well, it's the people's house today, depending on who is actually elected to speaker. The need for the Republicans to come together, where there were 31 votes from members of Congress against Kevin McCarthy as speaker. The idea is that that is one of those areas where Americans really do need to try to unite for a purpose. And we're talking before about Mark Penn and Andrew Stein, who are two veteran Democrats. Mark Penn was a pollster and advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton. He was one of the people who was in charge of Hillary's first presidential campaign. And he's chairman of the Harris Poll. And Andrew Stein was a New York City Council member. He was, in fact, New York City Council president. And they address a plea to President Biden not to run. And it's more important because these are Democrats, actually, when they are actually standing up to the president, and this particularly at a time when his electoral stock looked a little bit better because the Democrats did better than expected and better than they have historically. What they write in addressing President Biden and addressing him, the you in this commentary is addressed at the President of the United States. You have been allowed since the 2020 campaign to avoid answering tough questions related to your son Hunter, your brother Jim, and the family enterprise built to monetize your influence. You got away with calling Hunter's laptop a fabrication when it wasn't. And your story that you knew nothing about your son's business dealings when he was right there with you on Air Force Two will never hold up to serious questioning. If you pledge not to run, the Republicans should drop the investigation into your son and move on. Okay, there's a problem with that. Right now, there is an investigation going on, and it's from the Department of Justice. It's from divisions and agents from the Department of Justice, lawyers from the Department of Justice, who are there in Delaware. And how do you just call off an investigation like that? If you pledge not to run, the Republicans should drop the investigations into your son and move on. The country needs help to heal rather than more investigations. I think that is certainly true. But only 40% of Democratic voters support you for re-election, President Biden, a record low for a sitting president. Don't become another Jimmy Carter. You might be able to beat Mr. Trump again, but if he doesn't get through the primaries, you'll go up against somebody from the next generation of Republicans, such as Ron DeSantis or Glenn Youngkin, and the race won't be close. There is no clear successor in the Democratic Party. By choking off a primary process, you will set the Democrats back a decade looking for a new leader when they have dozens of governors, senators, and other officials who could run. America wants new choices. That's incontestably true. A new Harvard Harris poll asked respondents if they would consider voting for a moderate independent if the party nominees were Mr. Messrs. Biden and Trump. 60% said yes, they'd consider voting for an independent moderate between Biden and Trump. walking away from the presidency is like giving up the car keys because you're too old to drive safely. It's difficult, they write. But it's the right thing to do for each of you, for your legacy, for your party, and for your country, which must be allowed to move on from the paralyzing gridlock and the division of the last decade, which has been thoroughly ugly. The today, The Hill is reporting, by the way, concerning Lauren Boebert, that Adam Frisch, as I had mentioned earlier, her Democratic opponent, conceded formally, saying that an expected recount, which is mandated by the state's rules, was unlikely to change the outcome of the election, which is exactly what Lauren Boebert was saying. They agree on that. Frisch said that he had called Boebert to offer his concession. He said that while the race appeared to be headed for that mandatory recount, the likelihood of this recount changing more than a handful of votes is very small. And by the way, the division between Frisch and Boebert is enormously less than the division that Carrie Lake is facing. There was a piece yesterday by Karl Rove, obviously the longtime Republican strategist and a crucial White House aide to President George W. Bush, who talks about the ineffectiveness and sort of backfiring nature of the announcement of candidacy by Donald J. Trump. There are many primary and important Republican donors who have said they simply won't give to him. And part of it has to do, says Karl Rove, with some of the handling of money by Mr. Trump. Meanwhile, he writes, Mr. Trump keeps making it all about himself, even when he acts altruistic. Take the flood of fundraising emails he sent since the midterm soliciting funds for Mr. Walker's, this is for Herschel Walker's, December 6th Georgia Senate runoff campaign. I've received at least a half dozen such appeals each day, saying he knew he had to do something big to save Georgia. The former president asks for contributions to meet the official Georgia runoff fundraising goal, whatever that is. But it turned out that 90% of any donation goes directly to Mr. Trump's super PAC and only 10% to Mr. Walker's campaign. When the Walker campaign publicly complained about the deception, Team Trump lowered its skim to 50%. Hardly impressive. It's not as if Mr. Trump needs the money. He had more than $105 million on hand in five political action committees. Is he a formidable candidate for president? Of course he is. He is the former president. We will be right back with big movies, including one where there's the voice of President Trump briefly featured. Coming up. And there's something that almost is festive and holiday-like about the weekend before Thanksgiving, right? And a time to begin the process or to initiate the process and continue it as well, the process of expressing gratitude for living in this great country and for the opportunities we have to make it even greater. And that, it seems to me, after the election, is an appropriate resolution to put forward. There is a film out there. It's a very big film that is coming out on next Wednesday, and we'll give it a full review then. But it's a film we've spoken about before. It's called Devotion. And I alluded to it because it's a profoundly patriotic and life-affirming and beautifully directed film, and really one of the best of the year. But that you have to wait till Wednesday for. Today, we have this from Hollywood. She Said is probably the biggest movie coming out today. It's in theaters. It's rated R. And it's rated R because it deals with some very R-rated behavior. Behavior which is described in the film, but never shown. And what the movie is about is two real-life New York Times reporters. It's based on their book. Megan Toohey and Jody Cantor, who actually broke the story of Harvey Weinstein and his multiple assaults on many, many women. Film sounds like this.
We're from the New York Times. I believe you used to work for Harvey Weinstein.
People have tried to write this story before. He kills it every time.
Harvey adamantly denies any allegation of assault.
He played people. He was a master manipulator.
Will you give me just one chance to talk to you?
Are you sure that this isn't just young women who want to sleep with a movie producer to try to get ahead?
This is bigger than Weinstein. This is about the system protecting abusers.
The only way these women are going to go on the record is if they all jump together.
And that was what they eventually ended up doing. Ashley Judd is in the movie playing herself. She was one of the early people to complain about Weinstein and his whole record of abuse. President Trump's voice is actually featured, and it's not his real voice, but it's the best imitation I've ever heard early on, dismissing the Access Hollywood tape. But that's a brief distraction. The acting is terrific in this movie. And in fact, there will probably be a bunch of Oscars, including the British accent that you heard there with Samantha Morton. Zoe Kazan plays one of the two reporters. And Carey Mulligan plays the other. And they're both enormously convincing. Yes, it can't help you, prevent you from thinking of other films about intrepid reporters exposing scandal, like All the President's Men, and very much like Spotlight, which won the Best Picture Oscar. But this film has its own complexities because it also talks about the impact of some of this on the personal lives, on the married lives, because both of the reporters are young mothers as well. And it's a 3-star film. It is rated R because of very graphic descriptions of some of the behavior that is not shown on film. Sam and Kate is a different kind of film. It's entitled a romantic comedy. It's billed as a romantic comedy, but it isn't particularly comedic. It's got a great cast, headed by Dustin Hoffman and Sissy Spacek, and the son of Dustin Hoffman playing his son on screen, and the daughter of Sissy Spacek playing her daughter on screen. And it's pretty remarkable, right, to put that together, and especially to see that both the older couple that has a little bit of chemistry, that would be Dustin and Sissy, and the younger couple who has a great deal of Jake Hoffman and Skylar Fisk, who is the daughter of Sissy Spacek, their chemistry is real. She's a bookstore owner. He is a free spirit and aspiring artist in a small southern town. Listen.
Nice to meet you, Sam.
Nice to meet you too, Kate.
So you guys always pick up ladies in the church parking lot?
Totally. I was wondering if I could call you. We could hang out.
I'm not really dating right now.
Perfect, because I'm not dating anybody right now.
If you want to get a girl like that, you got to start acting like a man. Start acting.
It's been a long time since I've been out like this.
Why didn't you tell me you went on a date with Tina?
No, I had to.
My mom, she would call herself collector.
She's a beautiful woman.
Sissy Spacek is, and it's hard not to feel warm about this movie, but it's also tough to follow some of its predictable twists and turns. And for a romantic comedy, there's not a lot of humor. It's definitely downbeat with elements that are very sad. And with some attention to a major character, won't tell you in advance which one, who is a hoarder, which can be a terrible affliction. 2.5 stars it is rated R for some mild sex scenes and a number of sex references and some tough language. Spirited is a musical comedy, and this really is a comedy. It's very funny, and some of the music, some of the songs, which are by the Paskin and Justin, the name escapes me, but the same songwriting team that did The World's Greatest Showman and the songs in La La Land are used here. This is a new musical comedy version of A Christmas Carol, but in it, Will Ferrell plays an otherworldly after-death spirit who leads a whole squad of spirits to reform people in the way that Scrooge was reformed in Christmas Carol. They turn their attention to a hard-hearted businessman, selfish and stylish, played by Ryan Reynolds. Listen.
I'm your ghost of Christmas present.
Like A Christmas Carol?
Yes, yes.
I believe he can be a positive force for mankind.
People don't change. I'm here to change him to being a more positive force for humanity.
Clint.
Yeah. What I want is for you to shut up and let me do my job.
Is there a ghost of Christmas, Grumpy? Because you could do that job.
Okay, again, the film has a lot of laughs, and the dancing is terrific. The choreography is world class, and it's fun to watch. There's also, when you talk about chemistry between Ryan Reynolds and Will Ferrell, there is some real chemistry. They might become, if they continue working together, the next Bing Crosby and Bob Hope. Octavia Spencer plays a romantic lead in a very surprising way. And the movie just speeds along, deep and deeply affecting, like some older versions of Christmas Carol have been. No, not quite. But consistently entertaining, certainly. It's rated PG-13 for a few very mild sex references. 2.5 stars for Spirited. Coming up on Monday, there's a piece in Time magazine about how the midterms defied history. Okay, it's by Molly Ball, and she also answers what the defiance of history means for 2024. We'll be speaking with her. San Francisco has officially launched a guaranteed income program and intended for members of the trans community. The effort is dubbed Guaranteed Income for Trans People, or GIFT, right? What is it about the trans community that requires that kind of special financial attention? And in one state, there's a huge gap between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump. Well, the state is Florida, where DeSantis is governor, but Trump lives there too. Is that followed by other polls in other states? We'll know about that on Monday. We'll also be speaking with Mike Pence about his new book, So Help Me God, where he actually describes his experience as Vice President of the United States. He consistently refers to Donald Trump as his friend. In the book, the question is, where does their friendship stand now? Because it could have some historic impact on the shape of this next election, and what it means for the future of this greatest nation on God's green earth.